Voices in Time, recording life stories.
Okay, as the years went by, we continued to create traditions. Each home is a domestic church, and Bill is as the father of our domestic church, bless the children every night at bedtime. And we also prayed for our ancestors during prayers so that children have a sense of the faith being passed from generation to generation. And every New Year's Day, Bill blessed our home, sprinkling each room with holy water. He blessed the children and their pets, our cars, and anything in his path, asking God's blessing and protection for the coming year. Our friend, Monsignor Ty, used to tell us, create memories for your children. If you have to make a choice between a new carpet and a family vacation, take the vacation. So before each trip, especially the longer ones to the beach, Bill blessed the van with the sign of the cross on the windshield. And once when he forgot, the kids made him get out, you know, with 13 of us in the van for 22 hours, we needed God in there somewhere. Then one Saturday on the way to 5 o'clock Mass, we passed Ranch Mart and there was a RV in the parking lot with a for rent sign on it. And I said to Bill, oh my gosh, wouldn't it be great just to get into that thing and take off, because it was toward the end of winter, March, and everybody is really tired of winter by that time. So after Mass, Bill surprised us by driving into the parking lot and getting the number off the vehicle, and went home, and he called and made arrangements to pick it up the next day at noon. In the meantime, I called the principal at Cure of ours and told her we were going to take the 7 kids out of school for the next week. And we packed up and decided to take off for Galveston. Well, on the way, the next day, Bill had been driving most of the day when he got really tired. And he told me I was going to have to take over the wheel. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've never driven anything this big before. And he went back to go to sleep. And by the time we got to Dallas, it was 5 o'clock. And the 5 o'clock traffic had started. And I was on the inside lane and I couldn't get over toward the middle. So I ended up going off each exit and driving across and getting back on the highway all the way through Dallas. And the kids were laughing their heads off at me. And I told them, I said, don't you dare tell your dad about this. I'll never hear the end of it. So we got to Galveston finally and parked the RV on the beach. And a couple of days later, Bill and I had decided that we wanted to get out for dinner. And we planned on going to dinner. And by the time dinner time got there, I said, guess what? We don't have a car to go out to dinner. I said, if we go out to dinner, we're going to have to take the whole shebang with us, the vehicle and all. So we decided to go get steaks and fix them in the RV and send the kids out to dinner. So we gave them money to go to McDonald's a couple of blocks away. So we had our peace and quiet for a little while. We had so much fun on that trip that we decided to do it again. And this time, the second time we rented the RV, we went to Six Flags Over Texas. And we got to Fort Worth. I think that's where it is. And Bill went through the campsites and he said, these spaces are too close together. It won't do. So we found a cemetery and we parked the vehicle in the cemetery. And we had We had water for the, there was water being pumped in for the people to water their plants in the grave sites. And we parked next to this, the kids thought it was really neat because we parked next to this big monument that had a couple of brass boots sitting on top of it. And anyway, we didn't disturb anybody because it was a cemetery. And it was really nice because we parked our the RV in the parking lot at Six Flags, and it was time for the kids' naps. I just took them out and put them down for naps right there in the parking lot. So that was great fun. During Lent and Advent, we did beans in the bottle. Every night after dinner, each of us told what we had done for someone else that day, and we got to take a bean out of the full bottle and put it in the empty bottle, and it represented our good deed. On Christmas Eve, we wrote Happy Birthday Jesus on the bottle, took it to the church, and we proceeded to the manger and presented our gift of good deeds to Jesus and saying Happy Birthday to him. And then one Christmas Eve, I put the girls' hair in their curlers and their pajamas on them after all the kids had their pajamas on. We piled in the van and went up there, and then the group of nuns happened to be there in the church at the same time. So they joined our procession to the manger, and I think they had a lot of, you know, it was neat for them to join us. I think that made a good Christmas for them. And I often wondered what the priest thought when he saw those beans in the manger. And on Easter, that we said we drew Happy Easter and some kind of scene on the bottle and put it on the altar. And I thought, oh, the priest must really wonder where that comes from. But I think, in a way, he found out somehow. I know someone told him. Anyway, those were some of my favorite memories. And then we also had a Passover meal on Holy Thursday. Holy Thursday was the only day of the year that I serve lamb for dinner. And the little ones love drinking grape juice out of wine glasses. And during the meal, one of us would read passages from Exodus. This is a way of teaching our children that the Jewish religion is part of our Christian heritage. As one of the men at the Jewish Community Center said one time, roses are red, violets are bluish. If it wasn't for Jesus, we'd all be Jewish. Also, one year we thought it would become a tradition, but it never did. We decided to fix Thanksgiving dinner for a poor family, and we got the name from the Catholics charities. We were going to take them Thanksgiving dinner and have hot dogs ourselves. Anyway, so we fixed the dinner, took it down, walked in the house, delivered it to the refrigerator and their kitchen counter, and walked back out, got in our van, and one of the little boys said, "Hey, Dad, can we have a color TV like theirs? Can we get a color TV like theirs?" You know, Phil and I looked at each other and shook our heads. Bill also started teaching CD classes on Sunday mornings to eighth graders. And I remember watching him on the first day that he was going to teach it. He was pacing up and down the driveway out in front, singing, "Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?" And then in church, you know, we were trying to teach our kids to be good, And I would just pinch their arms when they started acting up. I would just pinch the top of their arms. And they usually would stop. But one Sunday, two of the children kept on playing around. And so I took them all home, drove up in the driveway, told all the kids to get out of church. And I kept get out of the car. And I kept two of them in the car, the two that had been acting up. I took them back to church to the next Mass. And I told them if they weren't good in that Mass, we were going to the next Mass. So that sort of stopped the playing around in church. But I remember one Sunday that a couple of the kids were acting up, and I turned around to correct them, and all these faces were staring back at me, and for some reason it just struck me funny, and I just started laughing so hard I got the giggles in church and I couldn't stop. And then one Sunday, Bill and I had all the kids lined up in church in about the third pew toward the front, and we got up to go to communion, and we took the kids to the communion rail with us, and the ones that hadn't made their first communion would just cross their hands over their chest to let the priest know that they weren't going to receive communion. And this one time, Bill picked Joe up and was carrying Joe up to the communion rail, and I looked at him, and Joe had the purse that belonged to the woman in front of us hung over his arm. So Bill went up to the communion rail with Joe in his arms, and Joe's the woman's purse hanging over his arm, and the woman had gone to communion before us, and she got up and she looked at the purse. She didn't say a word, do anything, and she went back to the to her seat. And she got her purse back then, but it was so funny. There was a girl in Lori's class. She came during their last year at eighth grade. Well, she was sort of different from the other kids, and she told tales, you know, and just to get attention. She always wanted attention on herself. Well, she liked our little kids, and she started coming to visit us all the time. She had a stepmother that she didn't get along with, and it wasn't her stepmother's fault, I don't think, you know, because Mary Jane was just really sort of different. Well, she kept coming to our house. Even after they graduated from grade school, she would come visit, you know, and a lot. And after I had Nick, he was just a baby, Mary Jane turned 16. And her dad rented a room out at Glenwood Manor. Is that the name of that hotel? It used to be out on Metcalf. And he worked in advertising, so he knew this radio disc jockey who was very popular here in town, and he hired him to come out to, and they got all kinds of food and everything. Well, Mary Jane invited all our old classmates, but told her that she was kind of this big party and everything. Well, she had told so many stories that the kids really didn't believe her. So I just nursed Nick, put him down in his baby basket, and I was sitting there about 9:30 at night, and Mary Jane's stepmother called in a panic. She said that her husband was out there at Glenwood Manor with Mary Jane, and they had all this set up, and nobody was there. So I said, well, just hold on for a while. So I told Bill I was leaving. I got my coat, got in the car, went over to a slumber party where Lori was with most of her classmates, and explained what was happening to the mother. And the mother took the girls out there. Then I went to the, knocked on the convent and went, told one of the nuns what was going on. And I told her to get on the phone and call a lot of people. And then I went over to Miege High School. And I knew there was a basketball game there that night. And I tried to find our nephew, John Grounie. And finally found him. I watched all the people leave the game. Couldn't find him. So I went to this drive-in on Highway 50, just a few blocks from Miege, where most of the kids went after the games. I found him there. He got up on top of a table and announced the big party out of Glenwood Manor. So Mary Jane was saved. Her dad was saved. And everybody had fun. They went out to the party at Glenwood, and it was a happy time. Also, there is Kitsy around the corner from us, who became my good friend after I followed her to kindergarten one day. It was for Joe's first day in kindergarten. And she had a son by the name of Michael. It was his first day in kindergarten. I followed her down 95th Street. I saw where she came out of Blender and followed her back home and asked her if she wanted to carpool. And so that started a really good relationship. Kitsy was, it was her first child. Joe was my seventh child. And so I was quite a few years older than she was. And she had had a hard time growing up in her home. Her mother wasn't the best of mothers. And I sort of became her second mother. And she depended a lot on me. And her husband started running around on her, and she would have panic attacks, and we just, you know, she just became very, very close to me. And when we moved to Westover, she would come every week, and he had stopped when she first found out about it. But then she went to meet him at the airport one day, and he got off the plane with this woman, and she, Kitsy, really, you know, got told him off right there in the airport. And then she came back to my house and had a good cry, and she finally left. Well, then Jack knocked on my door. And I opened the door and I said, "Jack, have you looked at yourself in the mirror lately?" And I closed the door on him. And Kitsy said, "That's what did it." And to this day, they have a beautiful relationship. And they moved to Texas, and they're still together, and they're doing great. Then Melody. When I was pregnant with Chris, I started having more problems. I had some after him with Anne-Marie, and the doctor had said, you know, be careful because you probably shouldn't have any more children. So I, of course, you know, as you know, can see, I didn't listen to him that much, but I did. I had problems with Chris, and the doctor said, "You need to get help in," because I had Marcy coming once a week, and that's all the help I had. And so this Father Bede that used to come to our house, he was part of the Society of Our Lady of the Most Holy Trinity, where they did a lot of work like visiting prisons and taking in the homeless, taking care of the homeless, and they lived down there by the railroad tracks. And Father Bede would come out to our house. He loved the kids. He would just stay all night with us because he said he wanted to hear the birds sing, you know. And anyway, he was out one night, and we were talking to him and telling him that we needed some help. And he says, I know the perfect person. So I sent Melody out. And the the very day after she came to live with us, she got sick with tonsillitis, and I ended up that first week going up and down the stairs, taking medication to her. We called the doctor, took medication to her, and took her meals to her, you know, waiting on her. And then the second week she was there, she said she was going for a walk on Sunday. And she left about 3 a.m. And at 9 a.m. she was still not back. So Bill says, oh my gosh, something must have happened to her. So he called the police. And right after he called the police, she walked in. And Bill and Melody got into it, you know. And he says, you just can't do those things when you're living here. He said, we've called the police because we were worried about where you were. Well, she had walked from Leawood into the bus stop and then taken the bus down to this area and reversed it. And by the time she got back, it was after we had called the police. Well, she was, you know, sorry. And then a couple of days later, we were working together in the kitchen. And I looked at her wrist and I said, Melody, have you tried to commit suicide? And she says, yes. You know, she had these scars on her wrist, and she told me that she had been in the psychiatric ward. And so that Bill got, you know, he said, why would Father send her out here? And we went out in the backyard, and Melody had told me about her upbringing in Sullivan, Missouri, that her mom had left at an early, left her dad, and her grandmother had taken her in, and the whole time her grandmother was saying, you wouldn't have a home if it wasn't for me, because her dad traveled and made her, you know, feel guilty for even living there. And she had to, as she got older, she had to work at the bus stop, at the truck stop, you know. And well, anyway, Bill asked Father Bede why he sent her out, and he said she had never known love in her life. And she said he wanted her to experience the love we had in our family. So Bill and I went out to the backyard, and we sat out in the backyard. And I told Bill, I said, you know, she's here for a reason. God sent her here, and I think we should, you know, give her another chance and keep her. So, but it wasn't like we had good help, you know. And she would have her ups and downs, and she would be overbearing when she had her ups, and when she had her downs, she would try to take the children with her. I mean, you know, try to take the whole family down with her. She was really a drag. And she weighed, I mean, it had to be 350 pounds. And we had to know when she walked in the door that she had problems. Well, anyway, she gradually, you know, Joe was in the tailor tot, or that's the old thing, anyway, she would put him in the stroller and carry and take him for walks, and you know, you could see her becoming more and more like. She belonged with the family and would contribute more to it. And I was going, always when I was pregnant, I always went to the beauty shop every week because I felt like if something looked good, I would feel a little better. And I talked to the manicurist, and she said, send her up here and I'll give her manicures. Well, she would get these manicures every week, and then she'd come home and give all the girls manicures, you know, and had a good time with that. And And by the time I had Chris, she was sort of a really happy person. But she called me Mary because I mediated all the arguments she and Bill would have. And after I had Chris, she burst into the hospital room and she says, "I am so happy, I'm so happy, because this is the longest time I've ever stayed in one place." Well, then after Chris was born, she left and she went to San Diego. And after a while, I got a letter from her, that we got a letter from her that I couldn't believe. She says, I found a guy just like Bill. After all the arguments and fights they had, you know, she says, "I found a guy just like Bill and we're going to get married," you know. And they got married I think she had I know she had about three children. But anyway, that was her story about Melody.
So how old was she when she came to you all?
She was in her early 20s, I think. Mm-hmm. That was our story for then. But mm-hmm. later on, after we had our lake house, she knocked at our front door, and I was on my way to the lake when we were on Westover. And she was going to leave. She was leaving her husband, and she had her three kids with her. And she came in, and she says, "I'm leaving my husband." I go, "Uh-oh." And so I said, "Melody, we're on our way to the lake. Just hop in the car with us." So Bill wasn't with us. We went down the lake, and I talked with her during that time. And I talked to her about, you know, kids needing their father, and she needed to go back to their father. And so she went back and stayed with them until her kids grew up, and she's still with them now. So I felt like I sort of had a kitchen ministry with, you know, one guy, carpenter, I talked into going back to his wife, and I thought, even though I'm home with all these kids, that God's using me, you know, God's using me. So, okay, now I have to talk about our camping trips, which is a riot. They weren't at the time, but they are now. After I had Chris, Bill decided to take a camping trip just for a couple of nights with a friend of his who had 10 children. He invited Bill to go on a camping trip with him. Bill took the older kids with him, and he watched as the teenagers set up the camping campsite, and somebody's birthday, had a big cake, and somebody else came to visit them to help celebrate the birthday, and well, they just had a lot of fun. And Bill didn't realize that they were all teenagers, and we had little kids. But he came home enthused about camping. So he decided that we were going to Colorado on a camping trip. Our vacation that summer, and we picked out Estes Park, the campsite at Estes Park, and every night, my gosh, every night he would come home. One night with a cooktop, one night with pots and pans, one night with bed rolls. And I mean, he kept coming home with all these things, and we were renting a scamper. And I said, "Bill, we've got all these kids to get in the car. Where are you going to put all this stuff?" He said, "Well, we'll just put them in the scamper." So we took off for Colorado that morning. I was nursing Chris. He was still a baby. I was nursing him. And we went to, we got to Kansas, and we took the wrong road. So we were 2 hours off schedule, had to go back to the right highway, and ended up in Denver late, and we got to the mountains late, and by the time we got to the beginning of the mountains, it started. We had a thunderstorm, really bad thunderstorm. So Bill and I looked at each other, and we went to a motel that first night. So the next night, we started going up in the mountains, and Chris started screaming. Evidently, the altitude was affecting his ears. So, I mean, all the way. And we set up the campsite by Estes Park, and we put the scamper up, and we put a heater in, we had all this paraphernalia for our 10-day trip. And but I couldn't help set it up, because every time Chris would start screaming, I put my poop in his mouth to keep him quiet so he wouldn't disturb the neighbors. I kept doing that. He'd sleep for like 20 minutes to a half an hour at a time, and then went back up crying. So the first night, the heater went out, and it got really cold inside the scamper, and we were all just packed in there to begin with, while somebody wet one of the sleeping bags and peed in it. So we had, and the heater, like I said, the heater went out. So we got everybody out of the trailer and fixed the sleeping bag. So we got the wet sleeping bag out there. Bill filled the heater with fuel and put it back. And we all got settled in. And the light on the heater didn't turn on. And then, so I said, Bill, you know, smell some fumes. We better put that outside. So Bill got up, put the heater outside. The next morning, we opened the door, and there's the heater heating the whole outdoors. And I, you know, Chris was still having problems. The kids had fun that day because the ranger taught them how to sing Row, Row Your Boat, you know, and things like that. But it was awful with, you know, Chris. I felt so sorry for him. And different things started happening, you know. It was just not working. So we packed up after 3 days and went home with all the paraphernalia. We were back in 3 days instead of a 10-day vacation. So Bill was still talking about, he still talked about camping. I said, Bill, we just can't do it with all these little kids. So he says, well, let's just try it for a weekend at the Ozarks. He said, you know, that was a fluke. He says, we'll try a weekend at the Ozarks. So he said, and you won't have to pack anything. He said, don't take any change of clothes for the kids. They can just wear the same clothes all weekend. I said, Bill, I can't do that because you have to have at least one change of clothes, you know. He says, I'm only wearing the same clothes. I have them on my back all weekend. So we piled all the kids in the car again on this weekend. We piled our tent. Bill had brought a tent for this. And we had the sleeping bags in the back of the car. Well, on the way, Lindy and Jan got car sick. So they threw up all over our sleeping bags. And then I put Lindy up in front with us, and she threw up all over Bill. who had the only clothes he had on for the weekend. So we had to stop, and he went into the service station and tried to clean up and came back, got in the car. Well, we got to the campsite in the Ozarks, and as we were driving in, Bill says, "Guess what?" I said, "What?" He said, "I forgot the stakes to the tent." So the campsite was sort of on a incline, and Bill not only didn't have the stakes to the tent, but we had to set it up on an incline with stakes that he whittled out, So he got this tent set up, and the middle of it, the top, you know, sort of caved in, and I said, "Kids, don't you go near that till bedtime. Don't even breathe on it." So we played around, and dark came. We put the kids in the tent for bed, and we put half of them with their heads toward the top and half of them with their heads toward the bottom. So every other one's heads is at the top or the bottom. And we put them in there, and we told them, you know, just not to move around a lot. And this little tent was just filled, you know. And there was rocks underneath, you know, the bottom of it. So we had to put all the sleeping bags on the bottom to keep, to make it more comfortable. Well, Bill was out reading his book at the picnic table, and the kids were sort of talking, and he says, "Be quiet." And a skunk had come up and was sitting right at his feet. So we were real quiet, and finally the skunk left. And after the skunk left, Jan says, "Mom, I feel sick." And I said, "Jan, get out of that tent as fast as you can." So she got to the doorway where Bill had put his shoes and did a perfect job of filling them. I mean, it couldn't have been any more perfect. So we settled down finally, went to sleep, and in the middle of the night, one of the kids says, "Mom, I'm cold, and all the blood has rushed to my head." So we got everybody out of the tent and told the kids that the ones who his head was at the top, they were to sleep the other way and vice versa. And then we got some of the bedrolls and put them on top of us to cover us because it had gotten cold. And we laid back down, and I laid there thinking of all that had happened. And I started laughing, and I could not stop. I was laughing hysterically. And Bill said, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "I don't know what else could happen." And it was like a cue. It started thundering. So we walked into an all-night cafe. It was drenched. And we ordered all these cups of hot chocolate. We walked in with our bag of donuts and sat there and ate our donuts and drank our hot chocolate and decided that it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and we decided that we were just gonna go right back. So we put our wet tent in the car, everything else, and came back home. And that's, Bill never mentioned that again because he knew that I would. I had a feeling he knew I didn't want to go back because I had really made it clear, you know? You know, one thing that really saved my sanity was my walk with Jesus. And I always looked in him when things really got me down. I remember one time sitting, I had taken all the loads of wash after I got them out of the dryer and put the laundry on our bed, which was on the same floor as the main floor. And But I didn't have time. I was going on errands and everything, and I didn't really have time to fold them right then. So by the time I got toward the end of the day, I went into the room and looked at all that laundry on that bed that was piled so high, and I just started crying, you know. And I was just exhausted that day from running in and out, doing errands and things I had to do. And I just told Jesus he was just going to have to, you know, help me get this laundry folded. And I just talked to him all the way through it to get my mind off of it. I always thought it better. I heard one time it's better to look at him than the circumstances. And so that's what I would start doing. And I had lists, but before I got out of bed in the morning, I never thought about what I had to do, because if I started thinking about what I had to do, I would become overwhelmed. And I'd just get up and start doing it, and it made everything a lot easier. And I remember one time when we were, you know, some of the kids are having problems with schoolwork and maybe other kind of problems, I put Jesus over in the corner of my kitchen, and I put my grandmother's old wash tub in. I had him holding it by the handles, you know, and I said, "Hey, these kids are yours first before they're mine. So I'm giving you all their problems too." So I would play like I had something in my hand, and I'd throw it at his wash tub and say, "That's so-and-so's problem." And I'd pick up another thing and, you know, like I was picking up another thing and throw it at him. And that's so-and-so's problem. And this is my problem. And, you know, by the time I got finished, I felt so good. So, because I felt like I, you know, they were in his hands. And, you know, I had learned to trust him. And I don't know whether you call that psychology or what, but it was, I given everything to him, and I just left him with him. Also, another one of my problems was the bills and the bank statement, because Bill said, you know, you have to balance that checkbook every month to the penny. And oh my gosh, Marcy, when she came back after she had quit, she said, I remember you crying over your checkbook a couple of times, you know, because I wrote all the bills, and Bill said, first of all, you have to write a check to the church, you know, for every month. Then you have to pay us. He says, you have to write a check to the savings every month. And he says, then go from there. And so, especially around Christmas time, it was really, you know, really hard to balance that checkbook. But I would do it every month. But it was really, you know, a chore. Also, one of the things, my veins in my legs would really bother me the last three kids, especially. They hurt, and I would, every morning before I get out of bed, I would wrap my legs in ace bandages. And I remember standing at my kitchen counter one day thinking, Oh, how badly my legs were hurting. And then I looked across the street at the teenager coming out the door. She had had cancer and had to have one of her legs amputated. And I thought, oh my gosh, I don't feel bad at all. You know, after looking at her, I thank God for my two legs. And I always offered up anything like that for some woman who didn't have her husband coming home to her at night like I did, and you know, had a lot more problems than I did. So, and I always pictured her as some young black mother, you know, who was single and didn't have kids. I always pictured her and offered everything up for her. And I hope to meet her in heaven someday. You know, and anybody else that needed graces, I would offer it up for. A lot of our clothes came from my mom's garage sales. My mom loved garage sales, and the kids used to love going on garage sales with her. Well, she came home from Rockhurst sale one day, and she it was so funny because she had a baby seat that she bought, and it was I had donated it to the sale. So that was a big joke. So I didn't really get to recycle it. She brought it right back home. And we got a lot of laughs out of that. And also, Bill's aunt Jean Dirks had some boys, and she was used to give us their clothes when they outgrew them, and they were nice clothes, and it was great. And then Eleanor Williams had she was Chris's godmother. She used to give us her girls' clothes, and in one package of the clothes, there was a ski jacket that Lindy and Jan loved, and they used to fight over it. So one day I took it and I said, "You get it, you get it on one day, and the next day you get it." So I marked it on my calendar. Every other day, Lindy and Jan would exchange the ski jacket. So otherwise we did have quite a number of fights over clothes, you know, with the girls. And I was so glad. Well, I ended up wearing the smallest shoes, and so I was so glad when they their feet outgrew mine. And the same with the clothes. They all ended up being bigger than I was. So anyway, that's how. Oh, there was a story about Anne Marie. I remember I had forgotten about it, and she reminded me years later. During the 60s, you know, they had these crazy jean type pants that had stripes, and they weren't even denims, you know, they were just funny looking bell bottoms with the stripes down in the buttons at the waist. Well, Anne Marie hated those pants, and she said she was so glad when she ripped her pair, and she came to me and she said, "Mom, I can't wear these anymore." And I said, "Oh, I have another pair just like them for Jan or Lindy wore." So she said she was really, really upset when I gave her that second pair. Christmas was fun, but it was exhausting. And I remember one Christmas Eve, Kitsy and Jack came over for a drink, and they stayed till midnight. And we had put all the kids to bed, you know, or about 10 o'clock. And we were all ready to put stuff out, and they stayed and stayed. Finally, they went home at midnight. Well, Bill wasn't too happy about putting things together on Christmas Eve. And we had this buggy this one year. It had to be all the wheels and the pieces put, you know, the handle put on, and all these pieces and nuts and bolts were in this package. So I gave it to Bill, and he went back for more things. I walked back into the family room, and there was Bill on the floor, on his back, with all these nuts and bolts and pieces of the buggy around him, snoring his head, snoring his head off. So you know, that was a long night. And, you know, with so many kids, there's so many things to put together. It was awful. And then I remember that next morning at 5 o'clock, when the little kids coming in with one of those corn poppers, you know how loud they were, coming in, "Look what I got." He was pushing the corn popper. Yeah. So after that Christmas, the next Christmas, Grandma next door, who I told you about earlier, she let me have her basement to use. And I would have all the things delivered to her basement. And on the days that Marcy came during nap time, I went over and put the things together. So on Christmas Eve, all we had to do was bring those things over to the house. Just carry them over without having to put anything together was a luxury. I remember one time, one Christmas Eve, I had put all the kids' Sunday clothes out, you know, for the next day. All their shoes, their everything. And Bill and I were down there at 3 a.m., you know, trying to sort things out. And all the kids came running down the stairs, all dressed for church. It was 3 a.m. And we were still out there. And I said, "Oh my gosh, you guys, Santa was here. And when it's not time for you to get up." I said, "Santa was here. And you scared him away. And if you don't go back to bed, he won't come back." I said, you better go back to bed. You just should have seen those ragamuffins at church the next morning. They slept in their clothes the rest of the night. And another year, we decided that Bill's family should come to our house for Christmas Day. Because everybody, there is all these grandchildren, our kids belonged to 70, 71 or 72 cousins, first cousins. And because Bill's family, all his brothers and sisters had big families. And so we thought we were going to have Christmas at our house. And we thought, oh, this is going to present a problem with Santa's stuff. So what we did was the kids came down on Christmas Eve, and there was all Santa's stuff. Santa had come a day early because he had to go. He had too many other places to go to on Christmas. So he started with us, and he left our household their Christmas present a day early. So while I got ready for the kids, for Bill's family the next day, kids play with her gifts from Santa, and we locked them in the den the day that Bill's family was there so that other kids wouldn't, you know, break them all up or tear them up. And we got sleep. It was the first Christmas Eve we really got some sleep. So that worked out great. And the kids loved it, you know. It was really a big surprise when they came down. Vince was the last one born when we were on Manor. And he was our number 10. And like I said, we were entrenched with the Curcio group. And Bill and Terry Hadle Bill was in the Curcio group, Bill Hadle. And so we were real good friends. He and his wife were Vince's godparents. And we had the baptism at 8 a.m. on Sunday morning at the regular Mass. And we invited all the Curcio group, which is a good-sized group, and back to our house afterwards. And besides all our family, and besides all the other people who had come to 8 o'clock Mass, we invited all of them back. So we really, really celebrated Vince's baptism that morning. it went, luckily, it was nice weather. He was born in August, and we could use our big patio too. So, anyway, that was a good time. One of the good times we had. Both our houses on Manor and Westover were always open to anybody and everybody, whomever wanted to come. You know, doors were never locked. And it seemed like people were in and out all the time. And I took care of my cousin's baby one time when they went on vacation, and took care of Bill's sisters, three girls, one time when they went on vacation. And then we had a couple of friends who, the father, they had seven children, and the father went into the hospital, and when he was going to come home for a weekend, we took all their seven children for the whole weekend because the doctor had said he was going to need peace and quiet at home, and it would be better if the children weren't there. So they came to our house for the weekend, and then Bill's sister, who had a brain damaged from the child and had convulsions a lot, she got pregnant after again, and she couldn't find a babysitter because no one wanted to take this one child. So I said, you get a babysitter for the rest of them, and I'll take Janie. And so we had Janie during that time and kept her for a while afterwards. And then after Betty took her back, we would go pick up the rest of her kids and take them swimming with us. So we always had other kids around us, other families. Bill's cousin was in the Navy, and they got transferred, and their son Chris wanted to play summer baseball, so he stayed with us that summer, and we kept him. And then the Christopher group that we worked with from Canada, they would come down on Christmas holidays and sometime during the summer, and they would stay at our house, and you know, we just piled them in, and Father Bede was always coming over. Oh, one time, Father Bede called from, and he said, this priest friend of mine is in town, so I want to bring him out for dinner. Well, he calls at 3:00. You know, a typical man didn't even think. And it was the day before I was due to go to the store, so my cupboards and refrigerator was empty, and I started looking around, you know, and I did have, I usually kept a canned ham in the refrigerator for emergencies like that. And then I was scraping together, and the kids came home from school. I said, you know, pick up your school bags and hang them up, and pick up whatever is yours and take it up to your rooms. And I was fixing dinner and trying to fix something nice for dessert, and they walked in, the two priests walked in, and by the time we got to the dinner table and sat down, it had been chaos all before that. So we sat down at the dinner table. Anne Marie was missing. She was like in first grade. I said, oh my gosh, has anybody seen Anne Marie since school? No, nobody had seen Anne Marie since school. So I said, oh my gosh, I wonder where she is, you know? And I called around to some neighbors. No, she wasn't there. And so everybody left the house, went out looking for her. And I had the phone in my hand ready to call, you know, the police. And you could do that in Leawood and expect, you know, a response. So I had the phone in my hand ready to dial. And here comes Anne Marie walking out from the den. You know, I said, Anne Marie, what in the world is going on with you? And she says, I was late getting home from school because I stopped to play on a trampoline. And so I thought you'd be mad at me. So I just went and hid. And then she heard everybody leave, so she came out. Anyway, like I said, there was always family, friends, and neighbors at our house, and you, the kids were the attraction. Everybody loves kids, and it was a happy place, and in a way, it helped our children to become used to being around anybody, and to get along with people and in the world. I thought it really was good that they were never afraid to talk to anyone, or, you know, they were always friendly. Never, no one was a stranger. And I was thinking last week, Lindy, when I was talking to her, she lives in Philadelphia. Lindy was the third one. She said, Mom, I am just so, I was thinking the other day how happy I was to have all those younger kids around me all the time, because they were so joyful and it was just so fun living in a big family. So like I said before, I was always afraid the girls would be burnt out by the time they had their own families, but it was just the complete opposite. So, okay, so that's the end of our manor time.
This has been a Voices in Time production. To learn more, call 913-831-0848.